This program was recorded an hour before the terrorist attacks at Kabul airport. Jewish News would like to wish the families of those killed a long life and a speedy recovery to the wounded.
This is the Jewish News podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Justin Cohen, and coming up on this special edition of the programme, we focus on the unfolding catastrophe in Afghanistan. Britain's eyes, the community's eyes, indeed the world's eyes, are now transfixed on Kabul Airport. Hopes of an extension of the evacuation of US troops beyond the 31st of August have been dashed, despite pleas from Britain, France and Germany. Since the Taliban advance on the capital, 80,000 people have been rescued, but thousands more still fear for their lives. We've seen heartbreaking pictures of desperate families handing over tiny children to soldiers in the hopes of saving them, scenes of echoes of the Kinder transport rescue from the Nazis. Some have yet to get as far as the airport, amassing outside, resorting to daring, life-threatening missions to get themselves and their families out. Others are already in hiding, hoping against hope, as Boris Johnson has urged, that there will still be a chance for safe passage after next week. Earlier, I spoke to Afghan-born councillor Peymana Assad, who arrived in the UK as a child refugee, about the incredible show of support from British Jews for her fellow countrymen and women over the last few days, from collecting essential goods to raising funds for new arrivals in Britain to helping with the actual rescue effort. But having been in Kabul herself visiting family and friends as the Taliban advanced on the city, Councillor Assad described how she literally ran for her life. Peymana Assad, thank you very much for joining us on the Jewish News podcast. You, in a way, were one of the lucky ones. You managed to get out of Kabul literally as the Taliban were taking over the city. That's how you came to be in the city in the first place.
So I go and visit my family every summer in Afghanistan, and I thought, well, I haven't been in 3 years because the last time I went was 2018, and because of COVID and elections and all of that kind of stuff, I wasn't able to visit. So I thought, well, this summer is a good opportunity. And with the looming withdrawal deadline of the 31st, I thought it's safer for me to just go before then. So I went and I was visiting my family and friends about the time recess started, sort of end of July-ish. And I was there for a good few weeks before the Taliban took over on the 15th of August.
And what happened on the 15th? How did you manage to get out?
So on the Saturday, everything changed, and my family said that because the provinces had been taken and they felt that Kabul was now surrounded by the Taliban, they had local intelligence that the Taliban had surrounded Kabul. And my family home is on the outskirts. So say we're looking at a London borough where I live, Harrow, say Harrow, would take a district like that in Kabul. That's where my family home was. And so they said if the Taliban enter, they will enter through this district and you won't be able to leave and you'll have to go into hiding. So you have to leave now, tonight, and we're going to move you to a location closer to the airport. So around about 11:30 p.m., I packed my bags quickly, said bye to my dog, my dog in Kabul, said bye to him and got into the car, and they took me to the other location closer to the airport, say 45 minutes by walk, but about 5 to 10 minutes by car. And I spent the night there, and then in the morning on the Sunday, about 10 a.m., the embassy called and said, we're evacuating you from Afghanistan, so be ready around 4 p.m. And they gave me a location point to be at. So I said, okay, I thought I'd had a bit of time. But then there was a knock on the door, and the neighbor came at about 12, 1 o'clock, and he looked really panicked and really worried, and he said to me, the Taliban have taken districts in Kabul. They're advancing onto this one and they're going towards the airport. You need to get your bags and you need to get out on foot. And so he said they've raised their flag and you, if you get stuck here, you won't be able to leave and it's going to be harder to hide. So I said, okay. So I got put on my trainers, grabbed my hand luggage, and they took me through the back streets onto the main dual carriageway. And as I hit the dual carriageway, there's just hundreds and hundreds of people just running, women, children, young people, people who had suitcases, just running towards the airport. And the traffic on the dual carriageway is completely standstill traffic, people getting out their cars and just running towards the airport. And as I was running, the shops, there's shops on the dual carriageway on the side, and all these shopkeepers had come out to watch the chaos and the panic and the commotion. And there was one specific moment that really hit me, is when one of the shopkeepers pointed at me and he said, "You, if the Taliban catch you, they're going to kill you, so you better start running faster." And that's when I kind of like it, the fear hit, and I started running faster towards the airport. When I got to the airport gates, they had completely closed them off. So they had put the barriers up and the cars were completely jammed in front of them. People were trying to push their way through. And I thought, well, that's not going to happen. So I went the other direction towards the safe location point that the embassy had given me. When I arrived there, I said to the guards at the gate, the Afghan guards, "I'm a British national. I've got a British passport. The embassy have told me to be here. Please, can you let me in?" And they said, "Well, I'm sorry, you're too late. The embassy have come and gone. They're not here anymore." And that's when like the fear really sank in me. And I didn't want to panic, but I was starting to panic. Like, what's going to happen now? The Taliban are advancing onto this area, onto this street anytime. And I'm here. And so I started walking back down the road, and all these Afghan families had come out to watch what was happening. And there was just a lot of people in the streets, just confused, running or panicking. And there was this one family that looked at me and they said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No, I've got, 3% battery. I need to charge my phone. I need to make contact with friends and family." So they said, "Oh, you can come in." And they let me charge my phone. They gave me food. They even offered me different clothes. They said, you stand out, so we'll give you different clothes. And that was when I was able to make contact with my MP and the Foreign Office. And I was told to go back to the location point at 4 o'clock and see if the embassy were there again. And so I told the family this and they said, "We don't think it's safe for you to go back on foot. So we're going to get you in a car and take you there ourselves." And so they put me in a car and they took me there about 3:30. I got there about 4:15. And when I got to the gates, I saw the British military were there and they let me in. And that's when I kind of sighed relief that I was going to be safe and that it was going to be okay.
Presumably, though, people who haven't been so lucky, who are still hoping to get out but are there in Kabul.
Yes, many individuals that I know, friends of mine who worked in the Afghan government, those who worked in the Afghan National Defence and Security Forces, friends and family, basically, who haven't been able to be put on any evacuation lists. I mean, their details are with the Foreign Office, with the MOD, but we haven't heard anything whether they're going to be evacuated or not. And I think it's getting harder hour by the hour, minute by the minute. And it's just complete chaos at the airport. People who have the right documents aren't able to get through, but then we're seeing people who don't have any documents boarding military planes and being taken out.
Have you given up hope that some of these people that you know won't be able to get out?
Yes, I think today really is the realization for me that a lot of people are going to die because we haven't been able to get the right people out, the people who are most at risk, the people who are connected to the government, who are connected to the security forces, connected to the UK government, to NATO. I think that realization only hit me today. I was holding on to hope for a while now, but I think because I've tried to evacuate so many families and it's failed, the realization is that a lot of them are going to have to go into hiding and maybe seek another way out.
What's your message now to Boris Johnson, to the British government, about what they can still be doing, because it's not yet too late?
Speed up the evacuation process. Look at who is at risk and get those people out. Figure out a way to organise a proper safe passage for these at-risk people to the airport, to the right location. The main issue is what we're seeing on the ground right now is that people who are eligible for evacuation have the right documents, are at risk, are our allies, have stood with us. They can't get through to the airport. They can't get through to the right location to be processed. And Boris Johnson can do more.
It sounds to me like at the moment, obviously, last week's debate in the House of Commons focused on the failures, the decision to pull out in the first place rather than maintain some kind of presence. We're now looking at a secondary failure on top of that, where you feel that the international community can do more and the British government can do more to bring people out now that they have got the world into this mess.
Yes, of course we can do more. I think that for a long time, a lot of European nations have relied too much on the United States. I think we've seen proof now that we cannot rely on the United States, that we need an alliance in Europe that can band together to try and help people in situations or crises like this. I think Afghanistan is proof of that, of what we're seeing right now on the ground, that European nations could band together and do something outside of this US strategy, US influence. You know, there's been lots of talk about the lessons and the failures of this intervention. But the reality is that Afghans will continue to live this nightmare regardless of the 31st of August deadline. Beyond that, Afghans will continue to be ruled over by the Taliban, have no control of their lives at the moment and be at risk. And so we can be doing more in that, one, we can try and provide safe passage and get these people out, but look to beyond the 31st of August deadline. I know that Joe Biden has said that he won't extend that deadline and that the US will be leaving then, which means that a lot of other countries will also leave. But that doesn't mean that we abandon the Afghan people. That doesn't mean that we overlook their cases and we don't find other routes for them to leave the country.
What can be done, though, in practical terms, after the 31st? If US troops have gone, if the Taliban have fully taken over the airport, what can be done in practical terms to support the Afghan people who are still there?
We can start talking to neighbouring countries. We're going to have to start talking to Iran, to Pakistan, to Tajikistan, to Uzbekistan. These are the neighbouring, immediate neighbouring countries, even China as well, because they do have a small border with Afghanistan, about how we can get some of our at-risk allies from Afghanistan out through neighboring countries and using our embassies in neighboring countries to evacuate these at-risk individuals. But also, I think the time has come now that we need to have dialogue with the Taliban. And it pains me to say this, and it's really difficult for me to say this, but we're in a situation now where we're going to have to talk to them to try and get our vulnerable folks out because their lives are at risk.
Are you nervous about speaking to us, to other media outlets, given the fact that you have got people still there that mean so much to you?
Yes, that's why I'm very careful in what I say exactly and how I say it, because what I don't want to do is put members of my family, but also my friends at risk on the ground who are currently, some of them are currently in hiding, others are currently on the run, others are trying to find a way out. So it's a real life situation for many of us. And, you know, I've given quite a few media interviews and I've spoken out against the Taliban's PR campaign and them saying one thing to the international press, but then doing something else on the ground. And, you know, some of those words, members of my family are telling me, you need to be softer. You need to stop saying these things in the media because you're going to put us at risk. And so I'm continuously hearing that, but I think it's important for us to speak about this because if the world doesn't understand or know what is at stake here, how can we actually pressure our politicians to take action?
And I think for all of our listeners, almost all of our listeners, they just won't be able to comprehend the life that might be waiting for some of those people, you know, some of the Afghan people after the 31st. You know, at the moment, Taliban are at least pretending in public that certain things have changed from the last time they ruled the country. You clearly place no truck in those claims. But what are these people who don't think they're going to get out? What are they saying? What are they doing now? How are they preparing for this new life?
I think a lot of people at the moment are in hiding and they're trying to just figure out next steps moment by moment, hour by hour. So things change quickly on the ground. As you can see that the Taliban only yesterday announced that no Afghans will be allowed into the airport anymore and only foreigners. But there is a lot of confusion of what that exactly means, because there are lots of Afghans with dual citizenship, you know, with two different passports, being Afghan-American citizens or British-Afghan citizens, for example, from getting into the airport. I think for Afghans on the ground right now, I am receiving messages of hopelessness, of feelings of abandonment, of the fact that the world has turned its back on Afghanistan and forgotten it and betrayed it. And so right now there is a deep, deep sadness in the messages that I'm getting. And I think people are just trying to figure out, if they can't get to the airport, they can't be evacuated, then can they explore land routes? Is that the next option for them?
On the news, and it's gone around the world, the contribution the Jewish community is trying to make in terms of collection of goods, of raising funds. You know, we're a small community. Some people might think that, you know, what difference can I as one individual make on the ground with such a catastrophe happening thousands of miles away? What impression have you had about what's been going on, and what would be your message to the community?
To the Jewish community specifically, I'd say thank you, because I've seen so many efforts from different Jewish groups across the UK in trying to support Afghan refugees through fundraising initiatives, through donations, through even trying to help the evacuation effort. And so for that, I'm very thankful. But also just to say that I should be proud. You know, I think the Jewish community are a huge example of how communities can get together and actually try and help those in need. From what I've seen, that's the best example that we have from the Jewish community, and it's an example for other communities to take, especially putting egos aside and working together to try and help those in need. And so the biggest thing I say is thank you, and the second thing I say is continue the work that you're doing, and please don't forget Afghanistan after the 31st of August, because the work doesn't stop.
Thank you, Councillor Peymana Assad. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
As British Jews continue to mobilise to support Afghans in desperate need, I also spoke to Paul Antoconi, Chief Executive of World Jewish Relief, which has launched an appeal backed by organisations across the religious and political divide. He was joined by the MP and former British soldier in Afghanistan, Tom Tugendhat, whose powerful words on the West's failures silenced the House of Commons last week. Amid fears on Thursday morning of a possible attack on the airport by terrorists operating in the country, and concerns of further security threats if US forces stayed beyond the 31st of August, I started by asking him if Boris Johnson was right to call for an extension to that deadline.
No, I think that the Prime Minister was correct in asking for the extension, though I think it's likely that the Taliban may have threatened it. I don't think it's likely that they would have actually followed through if the extension was only for a few days. Mm-hmm. So I still think that there's an opportunity, if the President of the United States were willing to ask, or to, in fact, rather to inform that he was staying till the 2nd or the 3rd of September, then I think that would be possible. But the reality is that this is a decision the President is going to take alone, and it will require the consent, maybe not willingly, but at least the tacit consent of the Taliban.
And you are in regular touch, I know, with people on the ground, people that you've worked with in the past, and trying to support the evacuation. Is there a growing sense from people that they simply won't be able to get out at this point?
I think there's a growing sense from people that this is chaotic and increasingly troubled. Look, we do know that not everybody is going to get out, and some people are already looking for alternative routes and seeing whether or not they'll be able to go through land routes. But of course, land routes means passing more Taliban checkpoints. It means increased risk. It means less chance of actually making it, or indeed more chance of being caught and murdered. So this is why people are trying to get out through Kabul.
And can you give us a sense of some of the stories that you're hearing about the levels to which people are actually going to try and get themselves out at this point?
Well, there was one friend of mine drove at night for about 8 hours with his wife and 5 children, which is an amazingly dangerous thing to do in most parts of the world. And it's a fantastically dangerous thing to do in Afghanistan, where not only are you dealing with the possibility of running into an armed militia, possibly Taliban, possibly bandits at any point, at any turning, but also the roads are very poor and it's extremely mountainous. So, you know, the very fact that he was willing to do that tells you how concerned he is about the future and his own future's safety,
and that of his family. But, you know, last night I heard reports of the Taliban beating people with metal bars outside the airport. So, you know, this is a very fraught situation, and one that I think the British Army and indeed others in Kabul airport are doing extremely well to try and manage, but it's extremely difficult.
Do you have any contact with any of the British soldiers at the airport or in the area securing it at the moment?
I've got contact with various of my friends who I served with at various points in the last 15 years, and it's clear that they're doing the absolute best they possibly can in some incredibly difficult circumstances.
Mm-hmm. If, as you've said, we already know that not everybody is going to be able to get out here, but Boris Johnson has still insisted that beyond the 31st, there should be ways of getting people out. How do you foresee that working without kind of Taliban support?
Well, I'm afraid I can't answer that question because I don't know what he's referring to. You'd have to ask him. But the chances of there being land routes out of Afghanistan is not zero. So I hope that some of those might work. But as I say, land routes are inherently extremely dangerous in a country where not only is the Taliban widespread on the ground, but there's also an increase in banditry and the dangers of that.
Paul, what I found particularly interesting in the last few days, obviously we've been watching these heartbreaking scenes from the airport. We've seen images of children being handed over to soldiers because the parents, you know, don't know what the future holds. Those kind of images obviously hold particular significance for the Jewish community, memories of the Kinder transport, which your organization, the World Jewish Relief, was obviously key to. How have these images been translating in terms of what you've been hearing and the messages you've been receiving from within the community?
Thanks, Justin. I think really probably since 2015, I've been bowled over by the Jewish communities and I should say other faith communities' outpouring of empathy and support for refugees seeking sanctuary in Britain. I think that might have waned then in recent years, but I think it's been quite remarkable how we've been, inundated with calls and offers of support and a willingness to assist, people wanting to open their homes from across the community, largely in response to, maybe first of all, the imagery and the stories, but also a resonance with what, you know, our parents or grandparents may have faced in the 30s and 40s. The fear of fleeing for your life and taking an enormous gamble. The gambles, you leave everything behind, you jump on a plane, you don't know where you're going to because you just don't know whether you're going to survive another week or two, is an enormous upheaval. Obviously, I'm pleased that there is a welcome that I hope Britain should provide to all those seeking safety and sanctuary from conflict. Of course, we've got to be able to translate that into well-thought-through plans that help those seeking sanctuary here in both the short and long term, so that they integrate well into British society. We help them with language and livelihoods and education and shelter and accommodation and health. The upheaval for those individuals is vast. It's not just a short-term emergency intervention to provide them with more clothes, because they're arriving with almost nothing for those getting on the planes at the moment. But, you know, it's many years of assistance that hopefully our Jewish community can assist with and assist others throughout this great country to make Britain a very welcoming place for those who justifiably need safety here.
I'm just looking on the website of the Board of Deputies at the moment, the incredible list of activities taking place within the community at the moment to donate physical goods, donate money. We've seen the great initiative by Sebi's Corner, by, as I said, the Refugee Trauma Initiative, by JCOR and so on, and opportunities to be volunteers at New London Synagogue and Aylith Synagogue and West London Synagogue. All of this is really quite incredible to look at. But I think there was a sense earlier this week that there needed to be a more coordinated, centralised effort from within the community. And I think you at World Jewish Relief have stepped up to do that with this appeal that's been backed by you know, every major synagogue movement across the spectrum, by the Board of Deputies, by the Jewish Leadership Council, by JW3 and others. Also, I'm proud to say, by the Jewish News. Can you give us a better sense about exactly what that money will go towards?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, we've got to celebrate every little part of this community, this small Jewish community, making big acts of kindness to do their bit. And there's space for everyone at a local level and at a more regional and even national. And full credit to the Jewish News for helping front and give us all the space and voice to be able to do that. It really shows the community at its best. And we know at times we may be slightly fragmented and arguing with each other on minor things. Actually, when crisis hits, we really are at our best and wanting to work together. World Jewish Relief is certainly not looking to own that space or even to be the key convener, but we are able to operate at scale, both internationally, supporting Afghans, certainly in and around Afghanistan, although operating in Afghanistan in the short term is very, very uncertain, but also assisting those nationally in the UK. I mean, our appeal is focusing both on needs in the region, immediate emergency needs in the region, and to assist those who are being resettled, firstly through the relocation scheme for those that have worked with British forces and other establishments in Afghanistan, and those that will arrive through the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme still to take place, still to kick off. I think our focus, as it has been for many years, is on language provision and helping people find work, because we know if you can earn a living, you can look after yourself, you integrate quicker, and you can contribute to wider society as quickly as possible. And we can see from those that have already arrived, certainly since end of June, and we have a number already on our employment programme in the north of England, they are well-educated, they are highly motivated to find work, they are celebrating having come to Britain and being made to feel welcome. And at a time, clearly, when we have employment shortages here in key sectors, I think they will rapidly contribute to our economy here. But there also will be others. And we know that the Afghan society is a very heterogeneous society made up of a multitude of ethnic, religious groups, all with different levels of education and a sort of a social standing. And we need to be able to adapt to those different groups. And there will be incoming individuals, many dependents, many with large numbers of children, who may be less literate and less well-educated and need far more intense support, particularly language support, to help them on their journey into education or into employment. Otherwise, they risk getting left behind, very isolated, very polarized, and then potentially go astray. And so I think providing them with a platform to be able to integrate is critical. But I don't also underestimate the need that there are some immediate needs. I take my hats off to local authorities and other refugee integration services who are doing whatever they can as this cohort comes in. It is still unclear which local authorities will accept how many where, and a bit of that is obviously going to come be about central government funding. But we are looking at where can we assist with immediate needs, and that might be helping with supermarket vouchers to enable food, clothing, hygiene item provision. We know that there are a lot of kids coming with families. They're going to need equipping ready for school. We'd like to get those kids into school as soon as possible. And I think those requirements will become clearer in the coming days. We're not looking for secondhand clothing. That's not the way that we work. I think we'd rather be ensuring we give people what they want rather than probably what we think they need. And as I said, that'll be an array of different requirements.
I think you're being quite modest there, Paula, in terms of the employment work that you've done in the past with Syrian communities in particular. You've been praised by the government as, I think, one of the largest, if not the largest, supplier of employment opportunities to refugees. So I'm sure that that's going to be a key part of your work going forward. Tom, both on this issue and on the Uyghurs, for example, another issue where you've been particularly vocal and where Jewish News has also been particularly vocal, the Jewish community really has stood out as speaking up and standing up for communities, for these other minorities. Just wondering what your impression is of everything the Jewish community has been doing in recent days. We saw the incredible pictures from Bushey Synagogue in Hertfordshire of those hundreds or even thousands of bags being donated in the space of hours. How does that make you feel? What are you hearing from people about that?
Well, look, it's very clear to me that many people in the community understand what it is to be a refugee, either firsthand or by a very close relative, a parent or grandparent. And indeed, I do too. And it's really quite striking that that memory has marked people, not as a trauma, although it was undoubtedly traumatic, but as a lesson of how to treat others. And I have to say, I think that's frankly inspiring. You know, many of us have got stories of relatives of ours, cousins, uncles, you know, grandparents, who have come over from, in my case, Austria on trains in the 30s with the clothes on their back and nothing more. And so to see the community responding in this way is frankly inspiring. Look, the other thing I have to say is that the cooperation between the community and other faith communities in the UK has also been extremely important. Because we've seen attempts to divide in recent years, and we saw it only recently with various protests in North London where people were trying to insult and rile the community there. That this is way beyond that, and that this community is standing up for faith communities, whether they be Muslim, as in the case of the Uyghur minority in Western China, or indeed from many different faiths as they are in Afghanistan. Although the vast majority are Muslim, there are also some Sikh and a few other sort of various different branches of Islam. So it's quite striking that this is a community that has responded with passion and energy to a crisis.
Paul, when you're dealing with partners on the ground in Afghanistan or in other parts of the Muslim world or other parts of that, people wouldn't automatically assume a Jewish organization has a presence. Is there a sense of surprise still that the community is taking a lead or is it come to be expected?
I think there's a welcome surprise. You know, in recent years, we've worked through local partners in Indonesia, in Lebanon, in Turkey, and our support, I mean, has been welcomed. People have wanted to understand, does it come with any particular strings attached? And it doesn't. We're very demanding, of course, in our levels of accountability. We want to see partners who fulfill technical standards, safeguarding standards, financial standards, that don't hide, I think, where the money is coming from, but we don't need to shout about it. We like to operate and be praised on our actions, not on what we shout about. But we recognise that there are some agencies that are uncomfortable accepting our funding because they fear it might compromise the safety or security of their staff or volunteers, and we clearly don't want to do that. I mean, it's interesting, the partner in Turkey with whom we're supporting the Uyghurs at the moment, a very credible operator in Turkey, absolutely celebrates the partnership with Jewish agencies, both in the UK and the US, and they're proving really effective at supporting at the moment the Uyghur community there and also potentially the existing and incoming Afghan refugee community. So I think Jewish support to those beyond the community, I think some would see it as welcome, a bit surprising, but not completely out of the ordinary. And in a world where, you know, we need to be finding ways to build bridges and be a little bit more tolerant. It's inevitable, and it's a bit cliche, I know, that we have far more in common than we do that divides us. And I like to think that World Jewish Relief fronts that. We had a lovely discussion recently with our Bangladeshi partner providing support to the Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar when we visited them recently just to check up on what we were doing. They said, you know, you're the first Jews we've ever met, and you look surprisingly normal. And how welcome it is that you're inspiring us to encourage us in our work. And I, you know, if we're the first Jews that people come across, well, I hope we paint a good picture.
Good. Tom, coming back to you, situation on the ground suggests that we may only have another 48 hours to get refugees out of the country. What do you expect to happen at that point, as soon as the troops leave, What do you expect to happen? What do you expect the reports to be coming back from the country?
Well, look, I'm very concerned for the safety of friends and people I've worked with over the years, because if they don't get out at the moment, there's a sort of a pause just after the Taliban victory that means that we're not quite at the moment where this is not yet being reversed. But I can see very clearly that any minute now, the revenge beatings and killings are going to begin in earnest. We know they've already begun in Lashkargah and Kandahar, and Kabul, the city of 4.5 million people, is surely only a few weeks behind. But the existing presence of journalists and so on possibly stays that hand just for a few moments. So I'm very concerned about that. I also suspect that what we're going to see is people movement into places like Uzbekistan and Pakistan as people seek to get out. And if that happens, then we need to make sure that the UNHCR and indeed organizations like Jewish World Relief are stood by to assist in any way that they can, because that refugee flow and those migrant camps will need a lot of help very quickly.
And the rhetoric we're hearing from the Taliban in the first days of their takeover, suggesting a relative degree of moderation when it comes to women and employment, is that going to disappear as soon as the cameras go off?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you mean by a relative degree of moderation. I think turning half the population into chattels and slaves, even if they're not beaten to death, is not moderate by my eyes.
It's just in the rhetoric.
And I know what I know indeed, and I understand that. And this is a Taliban that has learned from ISIS's extraordinary success in public relations in the early days of their campaign around Raqqa. Mm-hmm. But it has also forgotten nothing of its violence of the past. So I'd just be very cautious about listening to their words. I would look at their deeds.
And you said in your extremely powerful speech in Parliament during the recall last week that this doesn't need to be a defeat ultimately, but it's feeling like it already. How can the international community best rescue that? What is your message to Boris Johnson at this point?
Well, the fundamental thing that the international community must do is work together. And the errors here are legion, but one of them is that this was a unilateral decision by a single NATO partner, in this case, the United States. And what we need to do is we need to build up alliances and build up our own strength, so that although, of course, there'll be one lead partner and for the next decade, well, many decades, it's very, very likely to be the United States. Of course, that's so. But it doesn't mean it should be the only partner. And that's why I'm very, very keen that we build up European NATO, and we also build up our partnership and alliances with countries like Japan and Australia and, of course, India.
And Tom, just very finally, you are, of course, also the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Has this withdrawal and the way that it's been done damaged the Biden presidency beyond repair at the start?
Well, I don't know. I can't predict the future, I'm afraid, so I don't know whether it's beyond the repair or not. But all I can say is that this is a hell of a blow to the language that they began with, which was to reverse America first and to say America's back. And the joke going around now is that America is back, but it's back home.
Tom Tugendhat and Paul Anticoli, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, guys.
And that's it for this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit www.gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to thank our guests, Tom Tugendhat, Paul Anticoni, and Councillor Peymana Assad. Our technical producer, Leo Mendel, Adam Bradley for his work in post-production, and to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Justin Cohen, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.